turn back the clock. It's time for another Flat Chat. And as the latest issue of GP Racing hits the newsstands, we look at how Formula One is swiftly becoming no country for young men. As last year's Formula 2 champion warms the bench at Aston Martin, Fernando Alonso is proving you can still be rorty in your 40s. Which is a sentence I came up with and Matt Hughes stole for his feature. Anyway,
I know podcast etiquette is to wait till you're introduced, but literally we had the call and Mark was there at the end of the last podcast where you said the rorties with 40s line while we'd finished recording the actual thing. You said, you can have that if you like.
He did actually hand that intellectual property over straight away.
Anyway, where was I? Yeah, Fernando seemed to be 42 famously. Was it our colleague Luke Smith who once said, I love it when Cotters utters or writes the word famously before imparting a piece of information that nobody but him and half a dozen other people in the universe either know or give a toss about. But famously, 42, the answer to the ultimate question to life, the universe and everything. Joining me to discuss this and other pressing matters of moment are two people for whom 42 is just a number or a piece of purloined intellectual property. You've already heard from a very angry and animated Matt Q and a hello to Mark Gallagher.
I can only dream about being 41 or 42 these days. That's such a long time ago. It's accelerating into the dim and distant past. I hold on to the fact that Tom Cruise is my age and Brad Pitt, who's soon to star in a Formula One movie, is within a couple of years of me. So there's life in the old dog yet, I think.
It's funny, isn't it? And you thought Louis Chiron was cracking on a bit when he became the oldest driver to score points. What was he, 40s, late in his late 40s, early 50s, Louis Chiron? Yeah. Someone do me a favour and
somebody will tell you.
Google it.
Yeah.
Famously a former dancer for hire for the ladies at the Monte Carlo. He was basically a gigolo, I think.
I was going to say, that sounds like a polite way of saying he was a gigolo.
And in fact, if you borrow a tabard and walk along the harbour at the Monaco Grand Prix, you can touch his bust as you walk past the swimming pool. But anyhow, enough of Louis Chiron. For a while, Formula One was increasingly a young man's game. Max Verstappen hadn't even passed his driving test when he made his first appearance in a Formula One car. But now that's changing as teams pass up rookies in favour of older and more experienced drivers. In fact, there have even been rumours of 33-year-old Daniel Ricciardo being parachuted into AlphaTauri to replace Nick de Vries, himself no spring chicken at the venerable age of 28. Someone for whom 28 is a little bit of a distance off, let alone 33 or 42, Matt Q has written our cover feature this month, and you can explain why old guys rule.
Thank you for commissioning me for my first GP Racing cover feature. It's quite an honour. But you came up with quite a hard brief because we had to cover everything really in a remit, from the crop of F2 drivers that don't make it to F1 to why there's like almost a bias towards older drivers now with the regulations. And on top of that, why Alonso and Hamilton of the older drivers are exceptional. So it was no easy challenge to get it all condensed into the paltry word count you gave me, Cotters. But
when our managing editor gives me the word counts and I've written my brief, which usually goes to a quarter of that word count, I think, well, good luck getting all this in. And then I just send it to you anyway and go, right, now it's your job.
Absolutely. But so spoke to quite a few people, and I'm not looking for too much praise and adulation from you, Cotters, but as you should know, there's quite a few voices that we didn't end up quoting, just to sort of condense it and pick the best ones. So it was good to canvass quite a few opinions. And yeah, what stood out really are that Alonso and Hamilton are the exceptional ones, mainly for their mindset. Yes, there are mitigating factors now, you know, nutritions and physicians and whatever, that means they can sort of rage against the dying of the light, as it were. But just what's really come up is how modern F1 sort of better equips the older drivers. So the example I think I used quite early on, and I'll try not to sort of give too much of the feature away so that people don't go and buy it, but obviously Mick Schumacher getting flicked by Haas because he snapped the car in half twice last season and came back with a repair bill from the MOT garage of a couple of million pounds. And in a cost cap era, that's just, you know, when it's so congested in the midfield and that 2 million loses you a front wing and a tweaked floor edge or whatever, it's just it's not a trade-off that can be sort of swallowed just for a sake of, particularly for Haas, going, well, we'll wait in a couple of years and we'll take 10% of his salary when he's a world champion. It's just not a compromise worth making anymore. So welcome back to Nico Hülkenberg. And there's a trend across the grid for that. So worked out the average age, and ever since, I think it was in 1986 was sort of where it bottomed out. And then since then it has been steadily creeping. Oh, sorry, I've got my wires crossed. It was creeping down sort of consistently since 86 until you get to Verstappen's arrival, sort of 2016, 2017. And ever since then, we've been sort of gradually climbing back up. No major step change, as if, you know, for when Alonso leaves or comes back, but it's sort of a gradual rise. One of the factors is all the drivers are getting older. So it's quite a detailed average age analysis based on how many days and years they were at every single race. So obviously the longer people stick around, the older it's going to get, but definitely a more gradual trend up.
That was good, although I noticed that, unlike Alex Kalinauskas, you didn't send in your mathematical workings out on a separate Excel spreadsheet.
No, I can do that. In that case, well, we're crediting other people. I credit you for the brilliant rorties in their 40s line, and I must credit our good friend Jal at Motorsport Stats, who I think within 20 minutes of going, is this possible, sent me the average age of the grid at all 1,000 and however many Grand Prix in F1 history. So,
incredible.
What a dude. What a guy.
For an older person like myself, gosh, I keep mentioning my age. For an older person such as myself, having been around this sport for, you know, four decades, it is really quite something to see Fernando and Lewis performing as they are. I wasn't being rude a moment ago when you probably noticed I was looking off camera. I was just double-checking what I was remembering about Nigel. You know, Nigel Mansell, in those sort of dying days of his career in his 40s, you know, he'd been away from Formula One, had done the IndyCar thing, had come back again. You know, he had, you know, there was a kind of the sharing of the driver, David Coulthard, and then there was a popping up at McLaren. And it was all a bit sad. It petered out, really, you know, in a very unhappy way, really. And you look at Fernando today and you think, wow, this is something else. My own view, based on nothing other than, you know, being an observer of the sport, is that it did him a power of good to step away from Formula One for a time. It reminded him why it was so enjoyable, the joy he gets out of driving these cars. I think inevitably for a lot of drivers, there is a point at which the fun factor really disappears. It becomes a drag, you know, literally off to another race, another country, to drive another car that is never going to win anything. It gets soul-destroying. They decide to stop. You know, for Fernando to have survived whatever that sort of period was and then to come back into the sport and now be handed a car that, my goodness, is competitive, you know, like competitive for podium finishes, hugely invigorating. And I think I remember a conversation I had with Damon Hill at the end of his career when he was with us at Jordan. And, you know, that 99 season wasn't his finest moment. But I remember him saying to me, you know, when you get to my stage, you've won a world championship. He said, you don't want to turn up at another Grand Prix in a car that, in the briefing on Sunday morning, you're talking about finishing, you know, in the top eight, or, you know, in those days, scratching into a points finish. He said, it's not motivating. You want to turn up and win. If you can't win, it starts to become pointless. And I think that's, and I've had other drivers say that to me over the years, and I think that's an important point to remember about the drivers who have been at the sharp end, for like Fernando, like Lewis. That's what they thrive on. They thrive on the opportunity to really compete for the win, for the podium, at the sharp end. And, I mean, this year has been terrific from that point of view. I think it's saved a season, you know, so far with Red Bull domination. You kind of look to see, will Fernando score yet another podium? And the answer has been, you know, yes, more often than not. He's only had that one finish off the podium so far at the time of recording. So very interesting. And of course, it's a tantalizing prospect that on a weekend where Red Bull get it all wrong or something goes, you know, whatever, he could take a win. What a story that would be. Fernando Alonso winning a Grand Prix for Aston Martin. You know, let's hope it happens. It would be terrific. And then with Lewis, you know, to see him go through that cycle that he's having to endure, where the team haven't given him a competitive car, where he's getting questioned. All of a sudden, he's being questioned. You know, he must read the media and read social media just like anyone else. You know, people questioning: has he lost his mojo? Is he going to lose out to George? You know, during this period of time. And the fact remains that he's seriously motivated to still race in F1, keeps putting that message out there. Yes, he's got other interests, but no, he wants to stay in F1. He wants to win again. And I think with Lewis, there's that, sorry to mention it, but there's the added Abu Dhabi 21 dimension, you know, in terms of motivation. In terms of, like, really, seriously, did I not get the 8th championship because of that? You know, because of that appalling mismanagement that occurred. And so two hugely experienced, hugely motivated guys. And the great thing for Formula One, you know, particularly at a time of huge growth over the last 5 years, is that we got to a point where it started to look like we were losing our superstars. You know, Kimi was going, Fernando had left briefly, you know, who was going to be around? And here we are with two of the greats still in there, still fighting, and still fighting for podiums and for wins if they can get it. So I think it's a very strong storyline for Formula One at the moment. And fair play to Fernando and, you know, Flavio as his manager for pulling that deal together. Fair play to Lawrence Stroll for deciding to replace Sebastian with Fernando, and he could have looked elsewhere because it's actually been good, I think, for the sport. So I think it's a fantastic storyline. I really enjoyed reading the feature.
Yes, I think one of the things Matt did very well was asking Lewis and Fernando not to talk about themselves and why they think they're competitive at that age, but to talk about each other. And Lewis pointed out how basically sharp and alert and competitive Fernando is. And that reminded me of a story of Michael Schumacher's comeback. A photographer told me when he was working on the grid, I think it was the Chinese Grand Prix, maybe 2010, Michael was sort of going through his routine before getting into the car, put his helmet on, and he'd forgotten to put his balaclava on. And you know, this was the detail man who did everything right, whose preparation for races was legendary, who has just lost his focus to the extent that he can't even remember to put his balaclava on, which should be, you know, second only to remember to put your underpants on.
Well, actually, I love that story now because I'm not going to feel so bad when I can't remember whether I put the tea bag in the tea or not. Losing the plot over small things and thinking, is this some early onset, you know, kind of decline? And actually, the answer is you're just getting older and a bit more forgetful about stuff. And the thing about the Schumacher, it's really interesting you mentioned the Schumacher comeback, because I was very excited to see him come back into Formula One. And I was optimistic, you know, it's quite optimistic that we'd see some fireworks from him. And then when that didn't happen, it kind of underlined the fact that whilst going away from the sport for a little while might be a good break, going away from it for a number of years is really bad, because it showed that even the great Schumi could underestimate the challenge of coming back in after being away for those, what was it, three and a half years that he was essentially away from the cockpit. And, you know, again, it is interesting when you talk to drivers who have stepped away for a number of years and then get a chance to drive a car again. And they'll go, I just couldn't do that. You know, once you're out, you're out. And I think that's been what's been so great about the Alonso return, is that at least he went off and did other racing. He kept himself sharp. He clearly never lost his motivation to do Formula One if he could find the right drive. Coming back to some of the other points you just made, I mean, the Nico Hülkenberg story, I personally find it slightly uninspiring in one way, but again, you can understand, as you said, Matt, now, Günther Steiner can't afford to be handed a bag of bits twice a year by a driver. And that's not what they're paying these guys for. That's not why they recruit people in Formula One. There are certain things that are absolutely essential to getting the job done, that consistency of performance that you're looking. So whether the car's a race-winning car or whether it's a car that's only good enough for the ninth row of the grid, once the team knows where it's at, they want a driver who can deliver that performance with metronome-like consistency and also take advantage on the day when there's a particular safety car moment or an incident or a wet race where they can climb into the points. So that experience becomes, you know, incredibly valuable. And it is an interesting moment, I think, for Formula One that as the sport, as the cars have become so much more reliable, so much safer. So again, you know, if you're going back and looking at, you know, why did we not have many drivers sticking around for so long in the past? Well, they weren't going to survive that long, you know, and I'm talking about in the early decades of Formula One. So drivers came and went very quickly. Now we have the 20-year career in Formula One. It's not an outlier event, you know, it's something that a very good, competent driver, you know, a good, quick, competent driver can look for, you know, a two-decade career in Formula One. And I think, again, this is an interesting topic about Lewis and Fernando against a backdrop where periodically Max talks about the fact that he's not going to stick around for that long, you know. So will we see Max Verstappen at the age of 41 winning his 18th championship for Red Bull Racing? Adrian Newey having re-signed his contract at the age of 79
Adrian will be in on a carbon frame, carbon fiber Zimmer frame.
And you just can't see it with Max. You know, you can't see him sticking around that long. But it's, you know, today, you know, just before we were recording this podcast, I was reading a quote from Valtteri Bottas, you know, saying that I will one day stop racing, but it's in many, many, many years' time. And he's 33. So Valtteri clearly wants to, I mean, we know what he wants to do. He wants to get to the Audi era of Sauber. So he wants to be around 2026, probably wants to do a two-year deal in, you know, 26, 27. So what does that put him? You know, he's looking at being, yeah, sort of 38, 39, still in Formula One, driving for Audi. He'll be giving Audi the big sell on the fact that you need experience. You need a driver who's, you know, worked with the Sauber team, knows all the people in Hinwil. I know how to win a Grand Prix. I won 10 at Mercedes, so I can help you to achieve Mercedes to, as a, you know, I can benchmark your performance, all that kind of stuff. So drivers like Valtteri can position themselves now into the very long term.
It's interesting you mentioned that, you know, drivers who had long hiatuses, the likes of the pre-war drivers, the Sommers, the Chirons. Obviously, there weren't any races for them to race in, but there have been people who disappeared and came back a while later, like Jan Lammers, Bruno Giacomelli, I think. I'm convinced one of those will have had the longest gap between Formula One drives, because Jan Lammers was messing around in back of the grid machinery in the early 80s and then all of a sudden popped back up in the Leighton House or March in 91 or 92. And then Bruno Giacomelli, I think last seen attempting to qualify the Life W12 off the top of my head. I don't have a bottomless pit of data, but I'm thinking that, yeah, there were a few people who disappeared for years, but they were back of the grid material in the first place. It's not like someone of Michael Schumacher's caliber disappearing for 6 years and then coming back in something that was barely faster than a Formula 2 car.
Luca Badoa is a good recent example of that. But I thought on Mark's point on sort of Schumacher, I think the Alonso comparison is quite good, because it wasn't picked up too much, but he said in a roundtable session in Abu Dhabi last year, basically, if I'd have had, and this was quite soon after, you know, some of those brilliant drives where he was not angry somehow at Lance Stroll for catapulting him in the air, and then he like battled on in a damaged Alpine to get really good points, and he had a few outstanding race drives later on last season when the Alpine had breakdown. But anyway, He was reflecting on that and said, I needed that, because if I'd have had another season like 2021, then I'd have happily waved Formula One goodbye. You know, he said of his comeback year, I wasn't quite on it, and it did take him a full season to get up to speed. Like you talk about, you know, football players coming back from injury, and they need that full pre-season to get back to where they were. And it seems a bit like that with Alonso, to the point now where, yeah, his qualifying pace is good, but I mean, look what he's doing in wheel-to-wheel battle. It's not just so he can string a lap together. It's, you know, what he was doing to Carlos Sainz, Lewis Hamilton from the get-go in Bahrain. He is as sharp now, and it seems in every department with the racecraft in particular. And a line I did put in a feature is that it's been commented on that he has come back sort of, you know, a dress size smaller than he was last year. Not that he was by any means out of shape, but you know, to get there, he's had to put in the physical work as well to sort of keep his body in tip-top condition. But I think I'm not going to for a minute compare him and Michael Schumacher and try and make that, but you know, there are certain things that he has had to do, and the self-awareness to know that his comeback could have ended in sort of a similarly dispiriting fashion. But he what's the line I used out of rage against the dying of the light, isn't he? He's been a fantastic success story, and kept his team afloat. Well, not kept his team afloat, but you know, just done all the heavy lifting, and as that's allowed him to have a different side of Fernando Alonso, which is a nice guy teammate. He's been that far ahead of Lance Stroll.
Rarely has a Dylan Thomas line been deployed so effectively.
On
that bookshelf behind you, is there an Oxford Dictionary of Quotations?
That is a massive accusation coming from Codders, who hasn't said anything original since, I think, 1997. No, but Dylan Thomas, if you want to know, actually, it was a poem that was read at my granddad's funeral, so it holds a special plate in my light. So the line is, yeah, line's always quick to come to mind.
Our former colleague Ed Straw used to describe some of my comedy lines that he'd heard before as my writer's strike material, which Mrs. Codling was also amused by. So I did message Ed the other day to say that my wife, you'll be pleased to know that my wife is very amused to note that in Hollywood a real writer's strike is going on.
No, we just need to be grateful it doesn't coincide with another Bond film, because the last time a writer's strike happened, it was Quantum of Solace that was a steaming pile that was produced afterwards. But that's a tangential topic.
There will never be a worse Bond film than the one with the invisible car and the Sinclair Spectrum special effects.
Can I weigh in defence of that? An invisible car for 2002 is no more far-fetched at the time than a submersible car was, and I adored A Spy Who Loved Me, but I think that was in line. The rest of Die Another Day is appalling, but I will look after the Aston Martin Vanquish, not just because its number plate is K-E-O-2-E-W-W, so it's perilously close to my surname.
What about the pre-credits sequence where he escapes by
where he escapes Madonna
driving a we all want to escape that Madonna worst theme tune ever, plus little were we to know that she was going to pop up as a fencing instructor and just be terrible mouthing her lines there. Anyway, the pre-credits sequence of and listeners, feel free to correct me on social media if I'm actually incorrect here, but driving across a minefield in a hovercraft and not setting them off, this just does not work. They would have gone off anyway. There was downward pressure on the mines. They would have exploded. So it set in motion a whole torrent of stupidities, of which the invisible car was merely one.
I was going to say, in a film that includes a man having his face completely reconstructed and big, and yeah, I wouldn't call floating over landmines the most egregious like abandonment of reality. But anyway, I think read listeners who want to hear about GP Racing Magazine, Connors.
Talking about people disappearing and possibly coming back, we mentioned the potential AlphaTauri driver shenanigans, a team very much in flux at the moment. They're supposed to be the talent development team for Red Bull, but that tap has run very dry recently. Red Bull hired Sergio Perez to partner Max Verstappen because nobody in their own pipeline was up to the job. And more recently, Dietrich Mateschitz's death has led to regime change. And of course, whenever there is a change in boss, the people who are established there begin to quake with fear, a little bit like the cast of a soap opera when a new producer comes in and they know that their restaurant is about to be besieged or something like that, or they're going to die horribly in a fire, or a random plane is going to crash into the said establishment. Anyway, Oliver Mintzlaff is now in charge of sports marketing and media projects, which means he's in charge of the Formula One programmes, and it appears that he's not very interested in Formula One. Cue a clearing of the decks, and Alex Kalinorkas has very much enjoyed himself writing about this. You know, he's got into Game of Thrones and everything. I might have encouraged him to talk about people getting the chop. But it looks like the old guard is heading for the exit when you've got Helmut Marko publicly bemoaning the fact that Oliver Mintzlaff doesn't ring him after every session to find out what's going on. Franz Tost was planning to quietly slip out the door at the end of the season, but they had to announce that he was leaving because everyone had found out that he was going to be leaving. So, yeah, the question is what to make of AlphaTauri, and to quote an early 80s hit, where do they go from here? Not down to the lake, I fear.
First of all, great feature. Really enjoyed reading Alex's insights on that. Obviously, I know a little bit about the Red Bull story. I briefly reported directly to Dietrich and worked with him when he took over, bought Red Bull Racing before Christian Horner came along. And Helmut, had a good chat with Helmut in Melbourne. And the thing that should come as no surprise to anyone is that with the passing of, and it is a kind of premature passing of Dietrich Mateschitz. I mean, he was in his late 70s, but I think there was a view amongst anyone who knew them that he'd been a very fit, healthy guy. You know, he had genuine passion for all the sports that he was involved in, aviation, winter sports, motorsport. And I think his passing did shock people, and Alex, you know, mentions that in the feature. You know, even those who would have been quite close to him but I remember David Coulthard saying to me last year, you know, Dietrich's not in great shape, things aren't looking great, and sure enough, within a few months he was gone, and his passing was always going to prompt change because he ran the company in his own unique style. He was visionary. You know, this is the guy. Yes, the drink was invented in Thailand. It wasn't the Thai entrepreneurs who took it global. It was Dietrich who had the vision to take it global, to utilize sports marketing in the way that he did. And my goodness, built it into such a success. So his passing was always going to be big. His right-hand man on motorsport, Helmut Marko, was losing, you know, one of his best friends, and Helmut's turned 80, and time waits for no one. Christian Horner has spoken about this in the recent past, that, you know, Helmut is incredible for his age. He still jumps on planes, flies around the world. You know, he enjoys motorsport as much today. He could have packed it in a long time ago and lived very happily in his home town of Graz in Austria or anywhere else in the world he'd want to live. But Helmut likes being in the trenches. He loves being involved, and he's deeply passionate about the sport. So whilst, you know, I'm sure some of the listeners and some of the fans may not have a lot of time for Helmut Marko because of driver changes and various things that he's done through the Red Bull program, the fact remains that he has been in that role for, you know, close on to 20 years, well, actually over 20 years, because he was looking after Red Bull long before the Red Bull F1 program. And there will be change. I mean, there'll be change with Helmut because time waits for no one. I'm sure that, you know, with Christian, you know, Christian's staying there for the foreseeable future. Adrian Newey's just renewed his contract. Oliver Mintzlaff will be saying to them, I'm quite sure, keep on doing what you're doing. You know, the Red Bull Racing program has their, you know, full support. AlphaTauri is an outlier. Why did they do it? They did it because not only did Dietrich have this idea, this vision of driver development with Helmut, but also politically gave them an extra seat at the table in the Eccleston era of Formula One, two of the 10 places at the table, that, you know, 20% of the grid. That's no longer relevant. You know, I don't think, you know, the world has changed. Formula One has changed under new ownership. They can sell that team. They can sell that team for a great deal of money, a great deal of money, to be will have to change hands for any team to be sold today. Let's come up with a number. Let's call it $500 million or more to buy a Formula One team outright. One of the things we know is that it's a small posse of people looking to come in to Formula One. Some of them are serious and have the money. Some of them are absolute jokers, but are dreaming about it. And that AlphaTauri brand doesn't look like it's achieving its goals, doesn't seem to have a relevancy as a business. As you say in the introduction, you know, the driver development program has been found wanting. I mean, there's no greater example of that than the fact that they took on Sergio Perez, and actually he's the perfect number two for Max in the team in so many respects. Again, going back to what we talked about before, older, experienced drivers have been around the block a few times, know how to look after their tires, know how to bring the car home and get the most out of it. So change will continue. And I mean, Franz Tost, I've known since he was managing Ralf Schumacher back in the late 1990s. Doesn't surprise me at all that Franz would have known the moment Dietrich's gone, I'm off. I mean, he's 67 years of age. I'm quite sure he doesn't want to spend his 70s traveling the world going to long-haul races. He's still quite a fit guy, and he's got a lot of passion for sport. So all these changes are just kind of an inevitable part of it. I think we'll still see them come. I personally will be surprised if that team belongs to Red Bull by the time the 2026 era of regulation start. I think it'll have been moved on by then. And I don't think it actually matters whether Oliver Mintzlaff telephones Helmut Marko on a Sunday night after the Grand Prix. Why would he? I mean, he's got a massive empire to deal with. He can't go phoning every snowboarder, and hang glider that they sponsor, never mind phone Helmut Marko. He doesn't need to do that. I mean, he's got professionals working for him. So I think, you know, what we're seeing is just a natural evolution in the post-Matisic era. And I can't see the Red Bull's involvement in Formula One coming to a halt because Oliver Mintzlaff doesn't quite get off in Formula One as much as some of the other people have done. I think it's much more noticeable that, for example, Red Bull have done a massive deal with the Las Vegas Grand Prix. You know, that shows that, you know, their commitment to the sport in some ways might even be broadening. They may be looking at not just how does the Formula One team have impact, but what else can we do to utilize the growth of Formula One, particularly in the United States market, where they have not struggled, that's not the right word, where they've got competition in the form of Monster Energy. You know, Monster Energy is the homegrown drink over there. So with the growth of Formula One in the US market, you know, from a marketing point of view, Red Bull will want to be capitalizing on that. So I really see the team in Faenza as being probably surplus to requirements in the medium term.
I love the idea of, you know, needing a phone call from Oliver Mintzlaff at any point. Can you imagine, what was his name? Felix Baumgartner standing on the rim of space.
Spiraling out of control. Yeah. Getting
ready to jump off, and all of a sudden his phone rings. And he's, Mintzlaff, why is he phoning me now?
It is an interesting sort of comparison of corporate oversight, because if we remember to what, sort of 9-10 months ago, obviously, the Red Bull Porsche tie-up falling through because Porsche wanted to, in sort of understandably, I suppose, instill its own sort of boardroom level execs, and, you know, what that said of the position of Marco, who can't then go and mouth off to the press when, you know the board at Porsche are going to have to pick up their copy of Motor and Sport the next day and see they've been sort of slagged off. So those two couldn't like necessarily align, and it meant that sort of Christian Horner sacrificing some power. And now you've got it the other way around, where you've got against corporate oversight, but it's sort of hands off. I suspect that, you know, when Red Bull talk about turning down sponsors now, and as Alex notes, the deal with Oracle to have all that branding on the side pods, and even the Ford partnership, which is a commercial exercise primarily, and very, very secondary is some small technical overlap with hybrid power engine. It's all about making it as commercially viable as possible, so that, you know, they're almost beyond reproach. If they're successful and lucrative, then they can carry on. And even though the new CEO isn't a diehard motorsport fan, there has to be sort of, with Massachusetts Sun still at the board level, and there has to be some sort of what's the right word? Appreciation, I think, for Massachusetts' love of Formula One, and not to sort of just screw it up and throw it away immediately, sort of a grace period or whatever. Then you look at, you know, when Andretti are trying to buy their way in, it's interesting, and High Tech G Grand Prix, whether like the Fianza location will be a turn off, or it gets them a seat at the table, and then they can afford to blow a few hundred million more moving it to the right side of the Atlantic. Because I know there's Alex notes on it, there's in his piece, and there's been talk about relocating to entirely to Bicester, but having lived with a few Toro Rosso engineers in a previous job, and having lived in Bicester and driven past that, the industrial status on it's massively overcrowded. They're not going to relocate an entire F1 team there. So what they actually do with their base of operations, that, you know, it's not going to be a new March engineering in that little town. It's too small. So they'd have to relocate entirely. And is current ownership going to spend to either rehouse them all in one facility in Bicester or somewhere else? It seems like a big act. So I agree with Mark, you get closer and closer to getting shot of the whole thing. And to touch on the junior drivers, as I sort of mentioned in the piece, you can look at Perez as going like the damning indictment of the Red Bull Driver Academy. Now that Piastri's got his seat, who in F2, F3 is banging on a door quite so convincingly as he was, as you know, that bumper year of Norris, Russell and Albon, who's the next one? There isn't quite someone in the next 2 to 3 years to validate it. And you've got this position now where De Vries is under fire, but, you know, there were some people going, well, this is a logical route to being Verstappen's next teammate if he does well. But the fact he's not doing well and sort of getting demolished by Tsunoda, who is a very fast driver, but I don't think anyone's convinced he's a multiple race winner, world champion in waiting. If he's the star boy of that program, and again, it's not a very good reflection of where that driver academy that has produced Vettel, Ricciardo, Verstappen, it's not a great reflection of where it's at the minute. So if you're, you know, in the same way that Red Bull has signed all the lucrative deals to make itself as appealing on paper and as black as possible on the spreadsheet of accounts, AlphaTauri, just his position looks nowhere near as convincing.
Dominic Raab, there's an AlphaTauri for you. I find myself thinking, along the lines of where is all this clothing, whether there's like a vast warehouse full of unsold AlphaTauri merch. Or perhaps that's why the F1 people got it. It's like, we can't sell this, you lot wear it.
It's next to all the pallets of cans of Rich Energy, isn't it? There's loads of them, we just haven't seen them yet.
Yeah, Schrodinger's energy drink.
There'd be a free rocket telephone with your free AlphaTauri jacket.
I had two rocket telephones.
Did you? Really?
They existed.
These weren't virtual. They weren't virtual telephones. They were virtual telephones. It was an existential rocket phone.
It was an existential phone. It existed. I can't remember how I got one of them, but the second one, famously, won in the Williams pub quiz in Spa-Francorchamps, which the quiz team that I was part of won, despite Adam Cooper, the self-proclaimed Beatles maniac, getting the Beatles question wrong.
Might I ask what the pub quiz team was called that particular night?
It was not my doing, but it was called the Stuart Codling Experience.
I presume you won that phone from Williams prior to them suing Rocket for non-performance.
Yes,
of
just
sponsorship.
Just a few months.
Contract, yeah.
And with it, these phones came with accessories, one of which was Bluetooth headphones, both of which died within about 2 months of first being used. I ended up, I have to confess, flogging both phones to Computer Exchange for about, they paid about £25 each. I thought, fair enough. Also part of our haul for this quiz was a tremendous amount of what I will describe as rocket grog. This massive box of prizes I got included some bottles of their gin and vodka and brandy and quite frankly, there was no way it was any of it fitting in my luggage or getting in the car. So the lucky maid in the Airbnb or hotel or whatever we're in. I imagine somewhere in southeast Belgium, even today, there's these same three bottles doing the rounds. They get taken to parties. You know, it's like that bottle of Liebfraumilch in the 80s that someone, or the Happy Shopper wine that someone would take to a house party, and it would never get opened. And then the owner of the house would go to the next house party with this bottle, and it's still doing the rounds. So yeah, southeast Belgium, Happy Shopper wine, rocket brandy and vodka, and possibly even some gin doing the rounds still.
I think that there's really something in this idea of, there are lots of brands that have been in Formula One over the years that have prompted the question, has anyone ever bought it? Has anyone ever bought that actual? I mean, actually, to be honest, for years and years, I didn't know anyone who had drunk a can of Red Bull. When they first came into Formula One with Gerhard Berger, everyone was like, no one went near it. And then sometime later, when they started throwing money at the media, including building the energy station, people began drinking the product and realizing why it was that 2.5 billion people a year were buying it around the world. So, but anyway, AlphaTauri doesn't have much of a future, I wouldn't have thought. And although the cost of running that team will have been impacted by beneficial things like a fairer share of the prize money and, of course, the budget cap, so it's not the black hole that perhaps it was. I think the last time I looked, pre-COVID, Red Bull put $83 million into the team. That's a sizable amount of money to be throwing into your team to develop drivers who will never actually make the grade. And you can imagine that someone like Oliver Mintzlaff will be looking at it and thinking, we don't need this. It's surplus to requirements. So I think there'll be a really handsome payday for Red Bull. And I think it'll be good for Formula One, because if it does get bought by an Andretti or someone else serious, the team will go from being the kind of junior backwater team to being someone's pride and joy, and they'll invest in it properly. And I mean, wouldn't it be, you know, having now seen the impact of the vast, vast amount that Lawrence Stroll has put into the Aston Martin team, dragging what was, you know, Force India away from that tiny Jordan factory and, you know, the size and scale that it was into what it is today and building up the future for it. Wouldn't it be great if somebody did that in Faenza for that team? It'll be very interesting to see what happens. I personally think it's great for Formula One that we have two teams in Italy. I mean, yes, I love Motorsport Valley, but I think it would be a wrong thing if we saw all the teams ending up migrating to here. It's good to see that. It'd be good for the people who worked in that team in that area, the supply chain around there. But I, as I said, I don't think by the time we get to the 2026 regulations, we'll be looking at Red Bull with two teams in Formula One.
There's that very nice restaurant near there as well.
There's lots of good restaurants.
No, I forget.
It's in Italy. There's lots of good restaurants near there. I mean, literally, you're spoilt for choice with restaurants. That's got to be one of the main reasons not to relocate it.
Yeah, exactly. I doubt what are the culinary highlights of Bicester?
Well, there's Rigoletto's just outside Bicester, which is the kind of Italian that's been around since Leighton House days. I remember first going there with Ivan Capelli and Maurizio Gugelman. So yeah, that's and that's still going strong. But it's got very nice, very good Italian food.
Speaking of Italian food, let's send a food parcel out to the author of that feature, Alex Kalinorkas, who may even be at this moment still desperately spinning his wheels trying to get out of the media car park at the Autodromo Enzo Adino Ferrari. The race is cancelled at the last minute. People have actually had to go out there and set up. So it's still going to be very busy and logistically challenging. And as the calendar expands to 25 races or even beyond, there's going to be more of this, and weather is going to have a disruptive effect. It is tough on everyone involved. But as we say in this issue, the teams have no say in this. They're going to have to live with it. And this month, Mark found out precisely how they're planning to do that. And there's a pretty punchy quote from the Haas team manager, who says, in 2023, our biggest fight is not on the track. It's not in the pit lane. It's not in the grid. It's not in the paddock. The biggest thing we're up against is a 23-race calendar that jumps across continents and time zones. And I suppose, Mark, as we add races, that adds complication. You know, just a few weeks ago, we went from Azerbaijan, not an easy place to get to Miami over the course of a week.
Yeah. I was in America at the time, and lots of people were saying to me, that's a heck of a trip for Formula One teams to have had to make to our country. I mean, not being, this is not a commentary on Americans generally, but I had more than a few people at a particular event that I was at come up to me and say, where is Azerbaijan? And can you show me on the map of the world where Baku is? And they were quite shocked when I showed them just how far away Azerbaijan is. And so anyway, I really enjoyed doing this feature, and there were a few really interesting takeaways. So the first thing that I think needs to be understood when we talk about the challenge of getting groups of people to attend 23 races around the world is that there are no shortage of young people who want to work in Formula One. And there is therefore confidence when you talk to anyone, there's confidence that there'll be a pipeline of talent there. There'll be lots of people very happy to come into Formula One and get a crack at traveling the world and being at the sharp end of Formula One. So there's a tendency when this conversation starts, for particularly if you, my goodness, go into the Twitter sphere, you know, people are saying, it's so hard and all of these poor downtrodden team members who have to do all of this. Yes, there are some people who are finding it really difficult. But you know what? There are other people who are waiting to take their jobs, given half a chance. So there's not really a shortage. What the teams are therefore having to deal with is that to keep experienced staff traveling, they need to invest time, effort, and money in their travel, their class of travel, when they fly to races, when they get back, how many days they have off, whether remote working can be part of the solution. Peter Krola, the team manager at Haas, said to me that he himself personally benefits enormously from remote working, because he said, yes, it's incredibly tiring going to Formula One races. You come back from a weekend, you can be shattered. But he said, the fact that I can go home and spend a day, half a day, at my kitchen table, catching up on emails, doing a remote conference call, those patterns of work which have changed as a result of the pandemic in many cases, are actually very helpful. And when they then deploy that for traveling staff, they find that engineers and mechanics and technicians can have this kind of hybrid, have this hybrid working, which helps them to deal with the rigors of traveling around the world. Talking to Mercedes, talking to Haas, talking to Alpine, people are coping because teams are putting in place the systems to deal with it, giving people time off in lieu of races, flying people to races and saying you can have that first day off at the hotel or by the pool to do whatever. I thought it was really interesting to hear people talking about how they, teams talking about how they manage the welfare of traveling staff, even down to, again, Peter Kroll is saying to me, you know, we have someone who organizes social activities in the evening so that the team members get away from the racetrack, actually do get to socialize, go and have some fun. The point around curfews is really interesting. So I had two quite experienced people tell me that the curfews have been a game changer in terms of the welfare of team members, because they can't work on the cars into a Saturday evening. They can't pull an all-nighter. They can't, you know, just faff about. They have to have the cars under wraps within a couple of hours. They have to have the covers on. Contrary to popular belief, the track runs and the track cycles haven't disappeared. In fact, the teams make time for those who want to do that. So there's a huge amount of energy has gone into addressing this point. The fact is that more races are here to stay. And as I say in my opening remarks on the feature, there's a reason why races are being added, because they drive profits the bottom line of Formula One is improved by having more events. We will continue to have more. You know, you'll have to read the whole feature to find out all the ins and outs. But I think one of the things that was clear is that you know, not long before I did the interviews for this in Melbourne, Stefano Domenicali had talked about there being as many as 32 countries who wanted to have Formula One races. So, and when I raised this, you know, I think again it was Peter Crowler who maybe said to me, he said, if we start heading towards a calendar that begins with the number three, that will require a fundamental change, because by that point you will not be able to get, you will not be able to expect people to attend all those races. So you will need to have a rotation of staff. And he said to me that's already happening with some of their engineering colleagues. And again, talk, it depends what team you talk to, but again, I was talking to one of the mechanics at Ferrari, and he was saying, yeah, you know, he said, I've seen a few people who now opt out of a certain number of races a year. And we're actually seeing that not just within the Formula One teams, but we're actually seeing that in, for example, broadcast media. I mean, some of the listeners will no doulthspot the fact that David Coulthard isn't at every Formula One race for Channel 4. Martin Brundle isn't at every Formula One race for Sky. Why not? Because they actually don't want to do 23 Grand Prix. They will negotiate with Channel 4. They'll negotiate with Sky as to how many events they want to do. They'll have their favourite events. They'll have events that they really will view as being surplus to their personal enjoyment. You know, don't particularly, it's countries they don't particularly want to go to. And so across Formula One, amongst all the communities, you're seeing a change. But my ultimate takeaway from this is that the teams are dealing with it incredibly maturely with the with their travelling staff. And one final thing is that, and this is something that I've seen in other industries as well, there is what we now, what can be referred to as the hollow middle. So the hollow middle is where you have an industry where you start finding that there are predominantly young people and then much older people and not much in the middle. And this will be industries like, you know, for example, the armed forces quite often see this. You see a lot of people leave the armed forces as they come into their 30s, and you'll see other people get promoted to senior roles and they'll stay into their 40s and 50s. You see it in industries like the oil and gas sector, for example, where people don't want to work in oil rigs in their 30s and 40s when they have kids, so they want a job back at base. Similar thing happening in Formula One. So you're seeing the recruitment age dropping. So the race team is, you know, principally built around people in their 20s. They then look for factory-based jobs as they get older. And that kind of that transition is accelerating because of the number of races now. And, of course, not only getting factory-based roles, but also leaving Formula One entirely to go and work in other categories of racing, GT or whatever. I know lots of, you know, ex-F1 mechanics working in other categories of racing where their experience in Formula One means that they are highly valued by, you know, other teams in other categories. So really interesting piece, great. Cooperation from the teams in providing info for this. And I think the willingness of people to share how they're dealing with this challenge shows how earnestly it's been taken on. So, we're going to see more races, and you're not going to see, you know, you might see some people drop out of the front line, but the teams are well aware of the reasons for that and they plan accordingly.
Well, of course, Autosport rotates its staff, doesn't it? There's a changing cast of characters at every Grand Prix. Listeners may be surprised to learn that Matt Kew is not sitting alongside Alex Kalanorkas. He's at home. But you will be coming to Monaco next week.
Autosport's been proactive on that front for a couple of years now. It's we've split the main feature and main news role to sort of have a bit more rotation. And I have to say, I was reading Mark's piece, and I was very conflicted at certain points, because I am, you know, I'm in a, for if listeners care, I'm in a long term relationship, and as that relationship has gone on and my affection for my partner has grown, my sort of, I do miss being away more. Whether as we get even further into our relationship, I suddenly find my love of travelling for F1 increases. Maybe that's a wider reflection of where we're at. But certainly at the minute, Certainly at the minute I do consider that, and you factor in I'm at the point now where, you know, there's equal number of wedding invitations and whatever to turn down because you can't go because of Formula One. But every time I'm there and trackside and watching a car go around, you think, absolutely, this is why it's worth it. It's fantastic. I always find testing quite amusing because often if you stay at a place sort of near the hotel, sorry, near the track, as you leave the hotel, you see the night crew finishing their shift and sort of how drained and empty they look before the day crew on. So you know, that if that's where we're going to as a calendar sort of grows, I don't know. But then as sort of Mark says, you then have to have a reshift because the cost cap needs adjusting accordingly for, you know, personnel in and of itself and travel and hotel rooms and whatever. So it'd be a huge shift. But, you know, a bit like the AlphaTauri sort of case we were making earlier, it's all about what happens on the spreadsheet. So if more in this sense equates to more, then, you know, basically sod the HR department. There will be more races in countries that require longer flights from Motorsport Valley to get to. That is just the nature of it. And after the Brad Pitt film, if the popularity of F1, you know, begins to wane and territories, oil rich territories, you know, decide to withdraw some of their bucks, then yeah, there will be fewer races. But even for all the complaints of mechanics and fatigues and drivers, like there's a revolving door of people who will bite your hand off. So this is just where we're going, and sort of, I suppose you have to make your peace with it. And the thing is, Mark had this really good line in there. He talks about sort of increasingly it only matters to the people who have the unbroken record of 100% sort of race attendance. So it matters, and that's so true. If you know, I do three races back to back and then don't go to one, I might be sad, but no one gives a monkeys that I'm not there. And you know, it's you need to learn that, you know, I'm only a very, very, very small sort of part of the, you know, thousands of people that travel to each F1 race. But life goes on whether you're there or not, and so you will get replaced. And if you want to be the martyr that goes, no, this is too much, it's that's great, it's plaudable, but I'm very skeptical about the impact that will have.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of petty and stupid things happen in Formula One, but few as petty and stupid as the furore that surrounded Formula One's attempt to crown the journalist who'd been to the most races in the run-up to the 1,000th Grand Prix, because there were some people who were furious that they thought that their unbroken record was more important than... Who was it? What was it? Giorgio Piola who'd been to... It was a photo finish between Roger Benoit and Giorgio Piola as to who'd done the most, and there was a chorus of snitching and backbiting from some of the, you know, the people in their 50s who thought that perhaps having been to every Grand Prix since you know, the Japanese Grand Prix of 1990 was more laudable than having just gone to a lot.
Was it Benoit who, when we were in the Australia,
I couldn't even remember how many I'd been to when I was asked.
Well, he was in the Australia. Yeah. In the Austrian Media Centre last year, was it Benoit who was celebrating his 777th Grand Prix and then probably celebrated with a cigar and stinking out the Media Centre like he does at a lot of races? But that's a hell of a stint.
Yeah, I mean, the thing, I have a perspective on this, which is that I think some of the media who go to every race, I think it's great for a while. And then after a few years, you could really do with stepping away. I know that's not possible, particularly for many, particularly if they're freelance and they rely on Formula One as their main source of income. But I got to a point where I absolutely couldn't stand Formula One one day longer. Just didn't want to go to any more races, wasn't enjoying it, too close to it, too much in the thick of it. You get to know the reality of it, and much of the reality of it is not that special and actually quite disappointing. Because you get to meet the driver who you realize is literally just taking the paycheck and doesn't care anymore. You get to meet the engineer, he feels the same. You get to meet people who have no life, literally they have no life outside of Formula One. And I think that, you know, it's quite a shallow existence. To then step away from Formula One is a very good thing, because certainly in my case, when I left Cosworth and I just, you know, went off and did other things, within about 2 years, I really started watching Formula One closely again and finding it interesting again. And as the years have gone by, I've now gotten back to the position that I was when I was, you know, in my 20s. I love it. I mean, absolutely love it. But that's because I haven't got my nose to the coalface. Cotters, you kindly accredited me for the Melbourne Grand Prix this year, and I went last year as well. And you walk into the press centre and you see people who've been literally sitting in the same chair for, in some cases, decades. And I'm not sure that they enjoy it. They don't seem particularly happy. And I wonder how much they communicate to the fans accurately, you know, what's happening. So what's one of the reasons why, when I look at the media landscape in Formula One today, I think it's actually great that we have these entirely fresh, you might even say naive, you know, social media folks coming into the sport and reporting on it. Because I think you need all shapes and sizes. You need all perspectives. I think that's really good. And so, again, in the feature, you know, I make that point, Matt, as you rightly say, where it's actually in some ways becoming more of a it shows more of your standing if you're able to negotiate not going to all the races. And I mentioned a couple of the broadcasters, you know, Martin Brundle or DC, you know, for them, it's actually really important to get a break from it. And in fact, Martin often says to me, you know, that, or not often, he has said to me in the past, you know, that when he doesn't commentate on a race and he watches it on TV, it reminds him what the viewers are seeing them. It reminds him what it's like to be a punter. And that in itself is actually a really useful thing. So it is interesting, you know, to hear that sort of perspective. So, yeah, I think the, you know, well, I've been to every race for however many years. Is if it ever did have any kudos, I think that's now gone.
Yeah, on the subject of knowing when to leave, we've gone over the hour, so we're going to have to disappear off. Otherwise, our producer will have to start wielding the scissors. Probably, it's surely not in his contract. People don't even wield the scissors anymore. It's digital now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, and I fear for the Die Another Day segment at this point. It's gone.
But poor Martin, if when he gets to, you know, that point and thinks, yeah, great, that's 5 minutes of pure nonsense I've saved, then he gets to the end and has to perform a very clever edit to get rid of what you've just said. He's going to go, I'm going to kill them. He'll drive all the way up from his Dorset abode to bang furiously on our doors in the middle of the night. Anyway, at the risk of running on even longer and giving our poor long-suffering producer even more work to do, it is time for me to say thank you very much to my two esteemed contributors, soon to pack his bags for the Monaco Grand Prix, Matt Q.
Yes, I look forward to, I think I'm down on a hire, can't I? So I can navigate us through the south of France to the Airbnb that you have arranged. So I hope it's good.
Fabulous. I'll already be there because I'm now having to go out a couple of days early. We're going to be interviewing Lando Norris. So you might have to come to my posh hotel somewhere and pick me up. Currently planning his next hotel. It's Mark Gallagher. You look like you're looking at Expedia now, five-star, Monaco, Columbus.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how to join you. No, I'm sadly not going to be with you in Monaco. And all I can say is I'm insanely jealous. It's because contrary to many who say, well, you know, it's not really a race anymore. I still love the race, the Principality. I hope you have a great time and that the sun shines and something untoward happens during the race and we get a great result.
Indeed. Anyone who disses the Monaco Grand Prix just has never touched the bust of Louis Chiron.
Yeah, there you go.
One last thing, matter of business, don't forget the latest edition of GP Racing Magazine. GP Racing Magazine is out. Visit gpracing.com for the latest subscription offers. And if you want to know which shops near you sell it, then go to www.seymour.co.uk. Seymour as in the third wife of Henry VIII. With that wonderful store finder, tap in your postcode and it will tell you where to go. And now, before our producer tells us where to go, it's time for us to go. Thank you very much. We'll speak to you next month.